Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, if you are considering looking for a new job right now, or if you're trying to reinvent yourself and reposition yourself for a new career, you'll want to hear what Martin Yates has to share about getting the job. Dun and Bradstreet call him the best in the business, and for more than three decades, he's been helping people develop resumes and interview skills that get them the job. His 17-book series is headlined Knock 'Em Dead. I'm sure if you've looked in the career section, you've seen many of his books. And today we'll be focusing on the Ultimate Job Search Guide for 2015. And to give you some idea of how successful his work is and has been, the 2015 edition of this book is the 30th anniversary edition. So he really knows what he's talking about. But first, Nicolette Hahn-Nyman joins. She joined me last month. And she's joining us again today because at the end of our segment last month, I felt I still had questions. This is such a huge topic that she covers. And so she's with us today, and I'm going to go ahead and introduce her so we can dive straight into the conversation here. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman is the author of Defending Beef. She previously served as attorney for the Waterkeeper Alliance, running their campaign to reform the concentrated production of livestock and poultry. In recent years, she's gained national reputation as an advocate for sustainable food production and improved farm animal welfare. She's the author of Righteous Pork Chop, and we talked with her when that book came out. Since then, she's written numerous publications for publications like the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, HuffPost, and the Atlantic Online. She lives on a ranch in Bolinas, California, with her husband, Bill Nyman, and who happens to be a cattle rancher. So you probably remember me talking with Nicolette last month. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, welcome back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be with you.
And I want to just say for those who didn't hear you last month, just a little bit about the book that we talked about, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Which is literally the result of years of research, firsthand experience studying biology, working as an environmental lawyer and advocate, and raising cattle on grass because of now, of course, you actually work on the ranch to some extent, correct?
Yes. Well, I worked pretty much full-time on the ranch for several years. And then about 6 years ago, we had our first child, and I don't spend nearly as much time out on the ranch anymore. We hired some help at that point. But I'm out there for part of every day.
Yeah. So one of the things that, and maybe we talked about this when we very first spoke a few years ago, but I don't think we did, and that's how your husband got into grass ranching in the first place.
Well, we happen to be located. We're in Northern California, just a little bit north of San Francisco, and we're actually in a part of the world where there is a lot of area. Actually, California, the whole state of California, has a lot of natural grasslands, and many of these natural grasslands are along the coast. That includes where we are, and those areas actually are ideal places for grass because like our ranch in particular is a good example. It's very windy here for much of the year. It's also quite cool. It's often foggy. If you picture something sort of like, you know, the Irish or the Scottish countryside, kind of the rugged, you know, coast.
Oh, beautiful.
And, you know, with the sort of damp and cool weather a lot of times. That's kind of what it's like here, actually. And it's a really good environment for grass, but it's not a very good environment for much else, especially as far as the kinds of things that humans want to cultivate for food. So my husband started this ranch about over three decades ago and had originally actually started raising pigs, but then was increasingly aware of this idea that this was an optimal environment for grass and began to shift toward cattle and originally raised them entirely on grass. Then he did, when he founded the Nyman Ranch Company, he was involved in grain finishing those cattle for quite a few years. But we've come back about 8 years ago, we started this company that we have now called BN Ranch, and we've gone back to the totally grass-fed way of raising cattle. And especially for where we are, it really is a good way to do things.
Right. So I had a couple of listener questions, as you can imagine, after our conversation in December. And
yeah.
One of them was, okay, so if I'm going to eat meat, she is a meat eater and has tried to be vegetarian like many of us and gone back to eating meat. But
yeah.
what is the difference? She understands that grass-fed is best, but she was confused about something she'd read in a magazine about grain finished being almost as good as. So tell us what grain finished means when we're referring to meat.
Well, I'm a little different than some of the other people that are out there, you know, talking about these issues, in that I don't take as maybe militant,
right.
might be the word,
right.
a stance on that issue as some do. The way I have always learned it and seen it, and what's really been reinforced by my research, is that grass-fed, raising cattle entirely on grass, produces optimally healthy meat for many reasons. I can get into more detail on that in a second. But it also provides a lot of ecological benefits. But if you're just talking about the consumer end of it, and if you're just a consumer that wants to try to find the most nutritious meat, the nutritional differences are actually fairly slight. I mean, there are people who are really strong grass-fed advocates, and they will make the case that it's more nutritious, and it is. But the nutritional differences, if you want to quantify them, it's really a difference of vitamin content. It's a difference of the character of the fat that's contained and the amount of fat and so forth, omega-3s versus omega-6s. In every regard, grass-fed beef is a little bit better. But to me, those differences are not really significant in terms of when you quantify them. But that being said, there is quite a substantial difference in other regards. And that has more just to do with the norms of the American cattle industry. It's not necessarily inherently a problem with grain feeding. And, for example, today in the United States, about 95% of cattle that go through the sort of typical system that, you know, American cattle go through, and then, you know, a piece of beef in the grocery store, about 95% of those animals were given growth hormones. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether or not that matters, but a lot of consumers, in my view, the majority of consumers, would prefer not to have any possibility of growth hormone
right.
residue in their meat. And so I think most Americans probably would rather that not be in their meat. When you buy grain-finished meat, unless it's very explicitly stated that the hormones were not given to the animal, they probably were. Just statistically, it's very likely. That, on the other hand, I do not know of anyone that's doing totally grass-fed beef that is using the growth hormones. So there's no reason why you have to give growth hormones to grain-finished beef at all, but that is the norm in the United States versus the norm for totally grass-fed beef, which has no growth hormones. So that's the kind of difference that is not necessarily inherent to grain feeding, but it's just kind of the reality of it. So if you're a consumer concerned about health and nutrition, there are several good reasons to seek out the totally grass-fed option.
Right, right. It makes sense. And, you know, I asked at the grocery store, at the supermarket, where do you buy your meat from? And he goes, huh?
Right.
the butcher did. And I said, where do you buy, which farms do you buy your meat from? And he goes, we buy them from the slaughterhouse, so they come from a bunch of different farms. I was like, okay, I won't be buying my meat here anymore.
Well, and usually if you ask that question, they literally will kind of say it comes off the back of a Cisco truck. And that's all they know. I mean, they won't even know the level of, you know, and we've even, my husband and I, because, you know, we go around the country doing a lot of different events and speeches and meetings and whatever, and we always ask where the meat comes from if we're at a restaurant or a store. And quite often we've been, even like in a Whole Foods, where you expect them to have the knowledge, and the person that you're asking the question to will not know the answer. That being said, I still really believe the consumer should continue asking that question, because I think that until consumers begin asking that question, the retailers and the restaurants have no reason to bother worrying about the source, because they feel that it's not a concern. So I think by raising the issue, it's a form of activism. It's kind of a gentle way of saying it matters to me.
Absolutely. I think you're spot on there, and not just on this topic. We need to ask a lot more questions about a lot more things.
Yes,
I think we've just become
true.
I think we've become deadened too much. We just kind of accept what's happening around us. One of the things I wanted to talk about, and maybe we should go to break before we tackle this, because I'm suspecting this is going to be a longer answer too, and that's world hunger. We hear largely about this and how, you know, major agribusiness is getting huge subsidies to factory farm, which causes horrific atrocities, really, for animals and not the healthiest of meat, as we've already discussed. But I want to ask you about that, because in your book you say that if we recovered, we actually waste half of the food that we produce in the U.S. And if we recovered just 25% of the wasted food in the U.S., we could feed 20 million people. So let's go to break, and then we'll talk about that when we come back.
Okay.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. Her book is called Defending Beef, A Case for Sustainable Meat Production, the manifesto of an environmental lawyer and vegetarian turned cattle rancher. You're listening to Conversations Live. Please stay with us.
Eat steak, eat steak, eat a big old steer. Eat steak, do we have one beer? Eat beef, 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 it's a mighty good food. It's a great day meal when I'm in the mood.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. More than 30 books were adapted to full-length feature films during the past year. Films like Mockingjay, Unbroken, and Gone Girl. So what does it take for a book to make it to the big screen? Catch Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, on Alternative Talk 1150. And listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Open your ears, open your heart, open your mind. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Roberta Duran, 2 before 5, cause it gives a mighty man an awful lot of mighty mind. Eat steak, eat a big old steer, eat steak, do we have one beer?
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We are talking with Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, her book, Defending Beef, The Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher. And I just said to Nicolette in the break, and I should share it with our listeners, that I really enjoy her work so much more than many other books I've read on this topic, because you do take such a balanced approach to it, Nicolette. You can see both sides of the fence. You are yourself vegetarian, after all. And you spent many years as an environmental lawyer and now are giving many talks on this subject. But I wanted to talk about something you said, which is we waste over half the food that we produce in the U.S. And we see pictures of starving people all over the world. We're told sustainable farming cannot feed the world, and you say that's a total myth.
Yes. And first of all, thank you for the nice comments about the balance, because I think my training as a scientist and a lawyer has really made that be sort of the way I approach issues and problems. And I really do try to bring that to the food system issues that I write about. So there are a couple of really important points that I think need to be made when we talk about the world hunger and local hunger and food production and how we're doing it. And the first point that I think is very important is to respond to this idea that we hear everywhere that we need to be producing more, that the world needs to be producing more in order to feed these hungry people. And it's very important to note that right now in the world, we're actually producing more food per person than we've ever done in the history of the world. And in fact, it's been calculated by lots of different very credible people, like Dr. Marion Nestle at NYU and others, that we're producing almost 3,000 calories per person for the globe. And that's way more than enough to feed the globe. But we're not, right? There are almost a billion hungry people. It's estimated about 900 million hungry people. So one thing that has been noted by a lot of really credible people that are studying the food system is that it's really not an issue primarily of production creating the hunger, the lack of production. So it's really more an issue of who has the resources to buy the food and how the food is distributed and how access to food is created. And it's much more the way a lot of commentators would say is it's really an issue of poverty much more than it is hunger. Everywhere in the world, people that have sufficient money to buy food are able to buy it. And so that's a very important point to note. Secondly, when we look at the food system and we think about the question of quantity, and even if it were a matter of, you know, there's not enough food, which it really isn't, but let's say that it were,
right,
the food waste side of it would be an incredibly important part of it because, as you mentioned, Vicki, there's in the United States, it's around 40%, actually, according to research at the University of Arizona,
yeah,
that that's how much we throw away or don't. It's not strictly household consumer throwing away. That's actually a small portion of it. It's many different stages in the food system.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of food that is produced that never gets consumed. And so I'm really happy, actually, just in the last couple of years, there's been a lot more attention paid to this. Environmental groups are starting to look at this, and food policy people are starting to look at this more. Because the thing about food waste is it's not just, you know, troubling from the sense of, gosh, we're wasting food that should be feeding hungry people. It's also really troubling as an environmental issue because you put all the resources into creating that food, whether it's water or the agricultural chemicals or the fossil fuels, everything that you have to do to make food. The reason, you know, food is resource intensive and climate change causing, right? And then the food doesn't even serve its purpose. And then it goes into a landfill and it creates a it's the leading problem in landfills as far as methane emissions, because landfills are a pretty substantial emitter of methane, and most of that comes from decomposing food that was thrown in the food in the
right
into the dumps.
Right.
And so there are just so many levels on which the food waste problem is incredibly important and urgently needs to be addressed. And of course, that is something that each of us can contribute in a small way to helping, just, you know, in terms of our own eating and purchasing habits, trying to do less of the wasting.
Well, up here in Seattle recently, they passed a regulation where you cannot put food into your trash bin anymore. It has to go into your compost.
That's true in San Francisco as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's look at some of the other ways that government should be and could be taking action here. And I wanted to focus in particular on the animal cruelty aspect of it, because we can't, if we're talking huge agriculture, there is cruelty there. There's no other way to put it. People don't want to hear it. They don't want to see pictures of it. But it's horrific, right?
Yes. I mean, that's one of the primary messages of my first book, Righteous Porkchop,
yes,
is that our modern way of raising animals, whether you're talking about hens that are laying the eggs or cows that are being raised for milk, or whether you're talking about pigs that are being raised for pork, the systems are inherently cruel. It's not possible for those animals to live good lives.
So what should our government be doing? What kind of pressure? You know, I was struck when I went to last vote with everybody else. I was struck by the stupidity of some of the items we had on our voting list. It's like we're really not voting about things that make a difference. How can we make a difference? How can we influence our government into taking action on some of these issues?
Well, there have been attempts by sort of major animal advocacy groups for a long time, especially the Humane Society of the United States, which is probably the most politically important animal protection group. And they've tried having an Animal Welfare Act or just getting the current protections for animals that exist. For example, at slaughterhouses, there are pretty good rules, laws about animal cruelty almost everywhere, but they don't apply to farm animals. They're exempted almost everywhere. So they've tried to get that changed, and even that has been very, very difficult. The kinds of things I hold the most hope out for as actually being feasible on a national level are things like the banning of continuous feeding of antibiotics to farm animals, because that is absolutely common practice, once again, in these industrial operations. It's become the norm because of the fact that these animals are living in very crowded conditions, very dirty conditions, because they're continually living in their own manure and feces and urine. And therefore, the continual feeding of antibiotics helps to keep them alive in those kinds of conditions. It also fosters their growth, so it makes them get to market weight faster. So that's become the norm in the United States, but it's already been banned in the European Union quite a few years ago because it was a major public health problem and because you had the rise of antibiotic-resistant diseases as a result. And that's very well documented, that link. The meat industry still disputes that, but it really, in the scientific community, there's very little debate about that. So that, to me, is the kind of thing that has a very strong basis in science and medicine and public health, but it would also be very beneficial for animals because it would essentially mandate that animals have to live in more humane environments. They would have to be living in less crowded environments, cleaner environments, and it's the kind of law that I have hope for that could actually be passed. I think the primary change is going to come from consumers. So even though I think looking at what can be done on state or national legislation and regulations and enforcement, that's very important. We should always continue to do that. But in everything I write and all my speaking, I tell people you have the power. When you go and buy food for three meals a day, you have the power to vote with your fork and your consumer dollars for what kind of food system you want. And so that, to me, is actually even more important.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that you just don't think about these things. You go to the store and buy your packaged meat, right? But I didn't realize how far some of these animals are actually transported. And so, you know, we may see something's grown locally or raised locally, but that's not always the case. I read in your book that some of them, there's an actual law that says they can't travel for more than 8 hours because they have to stand up the whole way. And obviously it's cruel to keep them in those trucks coming across country. So I'm guessing one of the questions we also need to ask our butcher or our meat provider is, you know, actually where these came from.
Well, it's one of the reasons that, you know, it makes sense to try to keep some local and regional food systems and rebuild them. Because we had a lot of sort of infrastructure to have food that was raised and grown in our region, at least, not necessarily locally, but within our, you know, let's say a 500-mile radius or at the most a 1,000-mile radius. That infrastructure all still existed a few years ago. And I actually wrote an op-ed for the New York Times just less than a year ago, last spring, about the need for us to have local slaughterhouses and regional and local slaughterhouses and processing facilities for all animals in the food system. Because if we don't have that infrastructure in place, animals will be transported very long distances. And I think that's something that almost universally people oppose.
Interesting. I want to end today's segment with a question from a listener. He made a comment that I love what Ms. Hahn-Nyman is doing. And thank you, Vicky, for highlighting this by bringing it to us. But I fear it's all a losing battle. Big agri-farming has gained too much of a foothold, has too much power, and it's impossible to break, or is it? What do you say to that?
Well, I've been working on this for about 14 years. I started in 2000 when Bobby Kennedy Jr. asked me to lead this national campaign for Waterkeeper Alliance focused on the question of how animals were raised and the pollution that was caused from that. And I have to say that I was energized from the start by the importance of the work we were doing. But I, as well, at the beginning, felt maybe the obstacles were too great for us to really have much change here. And we began doing this work and worked very, very hard on it. But it did seem like it might be almost impossible to really move this enormous ship that was heading, you know, in this one direction. And that was 14 years ago, and my view is totally different now, because I've traveled all around the country on this issue in a lot of different capacities. I've been on farms and ranches. I've been in restaurants that are buying entirely from local farms. I've met young farmers that are people who didn't even grow up on farms, who are apprenticing on farms. I've met them all over the country. There's a huge amount of excitement and enthusiasm in people that are in their 20s and in their teens and even in their, you know, in their 30s.
Right.
For getting into agriculture and doing it in a totally different way. And even though we look at the average age of the American farmer and we worry about that, we say, oh my God, you know, they're 57 years old. And that is problematic, but it also creates a huge opportunity. There's a lot of need for younger people to enter into agriculture, and it's coming up very rapidly that it's going to be urgently needed. And so I think the whole way we produce food, the norms are going to shift quite dramatically in about another 10 years. And there's more and more consumer interest. There's way more consumer interest now than there was a decade ago. And that's what's really going to drive all this. So between the interest I'm seeing in the new in the young generation and the interest I see among consumers, I actually have a lot of optimism that a great deal can be done here.
Well, that's a great note to end this segment on. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, as always, an absolute pleasure. We need your voice out there telling us what's going on. The book, Defending Beef. And please give out your website so listeners can find you and find links to articles and your other book.
There's information about our own company that we have. It's called Eat Like It Matters. Our company is called BN Ranch. It's eatlikeitmatters.com. And then Defending Beef has a Facebook page, so anyone who's on Facebook can follow what's happening with the book and with these issues by joining that group.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And my guest again, Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, her book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, The Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher. And please stay tuned. We're going to change topics totally, totally in a different direction. We'll be talking with New York Times bestselling author Martin Yate. His book is called Knock 'Em Dead, The Ultimate Job Search Guide for 2015. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and we're totally changing direction now. As I said, we're going to be talking with New York Times bestselling author Martin Yate. He's one of the foremost experts in the field of job search and career management and has helped millions of people turn their careers and lives around. Dun & Bradstreet says of him, he's about the best in the business, and the Financial Times says, this is the best book on job hunting. And I would agree. I've not seen one that's so comprehensive and so useful as this one and so relevant. Relevancy is a big thing these days. So a little bit more about my guest. Martin Yate's career management includes success as an international technology headhunter, as director of human resources for the technology division of a public company in Silicon Valley, and as director of training and development for a multinational employment services company. He spent 25 years on the international lecture circuit coaching corporate recruiters, headhunters, hiring managers, career coaches, and resume writers on four continents. And he has a 17-book series, all of them in the Knock 'em Dead series. And each book, I'm going to bring him on, and he can tell us about each book in a little while. Martin Yate, welcome.
Good to be with you. You know what they say, Vicki, anyone can write a book. All you need is the lack of a social life. And I've done 17.
That's okay. That speaks volumes.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
But each of your 17 books addresses a different aspect of the job search, because there are so many aspects to this. And I know you've helped people in many different ways, and we'll talk about that along the way here. But I wanted to begin with something you said at the front of the book, and that is, it's time for enlightened self-interest. So tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I think probably everyone who is listening today who's working was raised with the lessons, either from parents, relations, or maybe someone at school or college, that says, you can do anything you want in America. All you have to do is get an education, get into debt with that, then start at the bottom and work hard and be loyal and hang on with 10 fingers and 10 toes. And if you lose one, hang on with 9, and you'll gradually be rewarded with increasing earnings and responsibility. And at the end, you'll retire with a house in town, a house out in the islands, and golly gosh, there will be your yacht bobbing at the end of the dock. And we know it's not true.
Right.
Yet our politicians have told us, the last two or three, yes, we know we're losing jobs, but they're rusty old nasty jobs. Vicki, you don't want those. What you want is a nice, new, clean, shiny job. And all you have to do is go back to college and get into debt again and start at the bottom. Same old story.
Right, right.
And it simply doesn't work anymore. It doesn't make any sense. And what I talk about enlightened self-interest is we have to stop thinking. And I've been in this business a long time. We have a coaching and resume writing company. And I talk to men and women every day. And it's the second or the third time they've been sideswiped by employers. And they still think, if I just get back to work, I'll be safe for the rest of my days. All I got to do is be good, put the company first. And what I say is, you are in the world of work for about half a century, about 50 years. You're going to change jobs about every 4.2, every 0.3 years. You're going to have three or more careers. What needs to be at the center of your loyalty is you, me, Inc. Start thinking of yourself as a financial entity who has to survive over the long haul. Start treating yourself as a corporation. You know when they say, hey, got to fire you, nothing personal.
Yeah, really? Not to you, it's not.
Nothing personal. And I'm not saying don't do your best for the company, but all I'm saying is, yeah, do your best for the company, but do the best for you too. Invest time for you and your future.
And I think that's an important distinction there, Martin, because I've talked with people before about, you know, Me, Inc. kind of philosophy, and they're like, oh, but I'm too dedicated a worker, or I'm not that selfish. It's not about being selfish. It's not about being a bad worker.
You're so right. You know, the first time I ever brought this up was a book I did called Beat the Odds. It came out in 1995. It was in the days when you used to actually go on book tours. And I went in 23 cities. And in every city, on every radio show, and almost every television show, I was called a communist and a socialist. And if I didn't want to be loyal to employers, I might as well go back where I came from. And now everyone's going, let's do a book on this.
Right. So let's ask this question, because this is one of the number one things that is so frustrating for somebody who is putting resumes on, is desperately looking. And, you know, desperation creeps into all kinds of areas here. But, you know, when somebody's desperate to find work and they're putting out all these resumes and they just can't get past technology, you can't get past that online submit your resume here. What advice do you give to them?
Can I disagree with you?
Yes, of course you can.
You know, I'm going to disagree with you with an example from technology. About this time last year, we were doing a resume for a C-level guy at a company called Microsoft.
Okay, we know that. We know that up here in this area.
You know, and I coach him, and amongst the things I said to him is, look, don't just rely on email and electronics. What I want you to do is, you know who you would need to speak to, take your resume, print it out, stick it in a big flat priority envelope, and send it out. And he said, you must be crazy, Martin, but I'm paying you all this money, and I got to get out of here. I'll try it. And that was on a Thursday. On a Tuesday, he called me and said, Martin, I sent five letters out, like you said, and I've had three calls already.
Yeah.
Now, the reason is it's contrarian thinking. You know, no one gets mail anymore. We all love a chance to get away from the screen.
Well, it's true, because I was raised to, when you want a job, go out and knock on the personnel door, or knock on the office of the, you know, the door of the person you want a job with. And you can't do that anymore because you can't get past security. But there are other ways around it. And
well, I have to tell you, we used to call this smokestacking in the old days.
Uh-huh.
You know, look for the smokestack. And, you know, so when you went on tour, you used to look for the radio mast and get the driver to take you that way. I have a daughter of a friend, got a job in the very, very high end of contemporary art in Manhattan. This is selling seven-figure pieces, right?
Right.
And she got it by walking into the gallery,
mm-hmm,
3 weeks ago. So these things, common sense does work. And the reason it does, at the heart of every job search, is the only way you're ever going to get a job offer is to get into conversation with the man or woman who can hire you. Now, typically, that's someone who holds the job title one, two, and three levels above you. So your mantra every day has to be, if you're doing a job search, is I need to get in touch as quickly and as frequently as possible with the people who hold job titles one, two, and three levels above me. And then if you're not getting results, you've got to go back to ground zero and say, if my resume and my job search techniques aren't working, I got to retool the resume and retool the job search techniques. And everything is changing so quickly because of technology now, it's probable that unless you've looked successfully for a job in the last 3 years, you're a wee bit out of date.
Right, right. So let's talk about how we get to meet these people, because this is a stumbling block for people. And I know, because I've talked to them, they're like, well, I want to work, let's say, let's use a Microsoft example. It takes legwork just to find out which department you want to go in, which person you want to speak with, what their role is there. I mean, it takes a lot of legwork. So how do you tell somebody to take a strategic approach to this?
Well, a strategic approach starts with, if it's a big company, everyone in the world of job search says, never talk to personnel, never talk to human resources. And, human resources don't make decisions. But if it's a big company like a Microsoft and you get a recruiter, she or he can probably get you six interviews in six different departments while you're finding the name of one person. But it all starts with social networking. And what we talk about in Knock 'Em Dead is the social network integrated approach to job search. And everything we talk about job search, we involve social networking in it in some way. Now, what I tell people is, you know, if you're not on LinkedIn, LinkedIn is the premier professional networking site, 275 plus million members, half of them in America, which means that's a big chunk of our professional workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you've got to have a profile on there because it's the honeypot for every headhunter in the land. And two, you've got to join groups, the special interest groups, that are full of people who have job titles like yours. They can have more or less experience. It doesn't matter. And you want the people with the job titles one, two, and three levels above you. And you want to reach out and connect with these people now and try and be of help and try and be part of the community. It's going to help you in this job search, and because we statistically, for over 35 years, we change jobs in America sometimes by our own choice, sometimes not, about every 4.2, 4.3 years, you're going to need these people again. It's knowing people in your profession that will help you through the insecurity of this work world of work that we now live in.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought up LinkedIn, because I know several recruiters who do go directly to LinkedIn now. They've skipped going through agencies and searching resumes. They go straight to LinkedIn. And we need to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'm going to ask you how to set up a winning profile on there. So we're talking today with Martin Yates, best-selling author of Knock 'Em Dead. This is the Ultimate Job Search Guide 2015, so very relevant. It's the 30th anniversary edition. And you are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. More than 30 books were adapted to full-length feature films during the past year. Films like Mockingjay, Unbroken, and Gone Girl. So what does it take for a book to make it to the big screen? Catch Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, on Alternative Talk 1150. And listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to NuPro Supplements, we cover the world of animals. This week, February 1st, it's Shelter, Rescue, Sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. We'll check on our regulars, birds, and horses, then we'll pick up where we left off with the Lean Fort Gang from Friends of Woodland Park Zoo Elephants. We'll find out the latest on the zoo's plans to close the exhibit and why our elephants simply must go to a sanctuary. Zoos versus Sanctuary, Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is New York Times bestselling author Martin Yates. His book we're talking about today is Knock 'Em Dead, The Ultimate Job Search Guide for 2015. I have to tell you, this book is packed full of really great information. We can't even touch on the surface of it here. But if you're seriously looking for a book, this covers just about every aspect of what you need to know about changing up your job search, because it's all about being relevant, isn't it, Martin? It's all about, you know, changing things up, and what worked 5 years, even 3 or 2 years ago isn't necessarily relevant today, is it?
No, not necessarily. One or two things never change, but a lot of stuff does change.
And so we were talking before the break, and, you know, I know this from several recruiters I work with, that most of them go directly to LinkedIn now. They cut out the middleman and they go directly to LinkedIn to look for people to fill roles. So what makes a winning profile? What makes something stand out to somebody who's looking?
Okay, I mean, I could talk for an hour on this, but let's just pick out a couple of headlines.
Yeah.
Number one, the first thing anyone sees is your photograph. It's on the top left-hand corner. So that photograph has to be you. It has to be the professional you. It has to look good. There are certain rules for men, which is your comb over shouldn't show. you shouldn't look like a slob. You should be dressed professionally. The angle of the shot, you should be looking into the copy, not looking away to the right, to the left-hand side of the page, because that's putting your shoulder away from the copy, sends the wrong message. There are rules for women that are slightly different. Women have to be careful about what they're showing. And for both sexes, we have to remember that LinkedIn is about getting hired, not dated. That's right. The rule of thumb there. And the next thing is your headline. Now, a LinkedIn profile, it's basically a resume. And if you do the resume right, it follows similar lines. But I can't tell you the amount of people that says, with a headline that says, talented professional looking for new opportunity. Look, guys. LinkedIn, to a recruiter, is a big database. There's not one of them that ever goes to that database and puts in the word talented professional looking for new opportunity. They put in accountant, VP engineering,
right.
Not talented professional looking for opportunity.
Right.
So you put in the target job title, and then you work it down from there. You should start with a resume. You should get the messaging of your resume right, the structure of your resume right, because that is always going to be your central marketing piece. And once you've got that right, you can basically upload it onto LinkedIn. Now, there are some things that are very important. They ask you to put skills down there, and you have to list what your professional skills are. And then you want everyone you connect with to endorse those skills and say, yes, he can spell his name. And you endorse their skills in turn, and little things like this help your visibility.
Okay, and then one of the things I liked in the book, you said on your resume, and I'm not sure you can change that on LinkedIn, but you can certainly add it, but most people have, you know, their name at the top, and then they have a summary. You say skip the summary, scratch the summary, but and call it performance profile, and I liked that a lot. Tell us why you think that works.
Well, every manager in the world and everyone in human resources knows what a performance review is. They're doing them all the time. So a performance profile says immediately, this speaks to what she can do. Most people follow their name and address with objective, which is what I want. And you know what? A recruiter doesn't care what you want. They want a target job title, and then they want to know, can you do the job? So your performance profile... we tell people when we're doing a resume, we could do something called target job deconstruction, which is you collect half a dozen job postings for that job, and then we tear them apart and we prioritize the needs that are common to all, the words that they all use, and then that's a template for writing the resume. And your performance profile, it's not a summary of all the things you've done. It's a summary of the top four or five things you've done that are relevant to the people who are hiring for this job. So they get a target job title that say, oh, yes, we're looking for that. Performance profile, no more than 7 lines long ever, because longer than that is very difficult to penetrate with the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And those 6 or 7 lines just encapsulate that you can do this job. And then we follow it with a section called professional skills, 3 columns of all the skills you have that are relevant to the job. These come near the top of the page. It helps your visibility in the database. You repeat them in the context of the jobs you've got, which doubles the amount of time they used. And that, again, increases your discoverability.
Great. In the book, you have a chapter called The 5 Secrets of the Hire. And I wanted to look at the second secret. Every job is about problem anticipation, identification, prevention and solution, which kind of adds on to what you were just talking about. Recruiters don't go to find out what you're looking for. It's what they're looking for. So tell us how we make sure that they know we're good at these things, problem anticipation and prevention, et cetera.
Let's look at this. Every job, doesn't matter what the job is, how senior you are, how junior you are, if you, dear listener, and I and Vicky owned a company, we wouldn't ever add anyone to the payroll unless they were going to help make us money,
right,
save us money, or in otherwise increase productivity, because that's taking money out of our pockets. Now, if we can get a piece of software to do it, we're going to do that. No job. If we can get it done in Mumbai, India for $5 an hour, we're going to do that. If the job exists in America, it's because they need American skills, needs to be on the ground here, and every job at its core is to stop giving your manager headaches. When you're sitting there sweaty-palmed in the lobby, the manager's on the other side of the door, slipping to his knees, clasping his hands, looking up in the sky and saying, please, Lord, let this be the one who can do the job and can play well with others. Then I can hire and get back to my job. And if we recognize this, at the core of every job in the world, your responsibility is not to give your boss headaches. So your job is to be able to identify and prevent problems from arriving on your desk by the way you do your work. 2, to solve them when they arrive nevertheless. And 3, to solve them in a way that shows respect for the next person down the line who has to deal with your work product.
Yeah. And I can tell you myself, as somebody who used to hire thousands of people over the years, that I look for that light and that ability to solve a problem. I can teach the rest of it. That's something you can't teach.
No, you can't teach it. And you know, following on from this, you know, we make our evaluations of people based on 2 things. What they say, the statements they make, and the questions they ask. Because the questions you ask show your engagement with the job. And if you know employers want someone who can identify, prevent, and solve problems, they ask you about a question. You know, how much experience do you have with accounts receivable? You tell them, and then you follow it up with a question of your own that shows your grasp of the job. You know, would it be okay if I asked, what are the biggest problems you have with collections at the moment?
Right.
That's much better. Do you have dental? Do you have a dental plan?
Yes, that shouldn't even be brought up in a first interview.
No.
But so it's about having a conversation, and yes, you want to allow your interviewer to speak, but you've got to respond in a conversational kind of manner so that they feel there's a light there behind those eyes. There,
you know, I once said that it's a bit like job interviewing is a bit like ballroom dancing. It's where the right partners waltz away with the glittering prizes.
I love that. Well,
and it's we have 2 people in front of us, one who answers all the questions, and one who answers the questions and asks intelligent questions about the job that shows she gets it and is engaged. There's no question who we're going to hire, is there?
That's right. Martin Yate, this is such a great book. It's so packed full of information. We're right at the end of our segment. Listeners can find out more about you at, it's knockanddead.com, right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, knockanddead.com. In this book we're talking about today is the Ultimate Job Search Guide, updated for 2015. It's the 30th anniversary edition, so we know that the tools are in here work. Martin Yate, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate
it. Hey, I hope your wonderful spring continues. Thank you, Vicky. God bless everyone.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank you for being with us today. If you have any questions or feedback on today's show, you can find me at info@conversationslive.net. info@conversationslive.net, or you can call me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. And you can also find me on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. I think that's about it for today. So I want to thank you all for being with us. And we'll be back next week with a brand new live show. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. More than 30 books were adapted to full-length feature films during the past year. Films like Mockingjay, Unbroken, and Gone Girl. So what does it take for a book to make it to the big screen? Catch Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern on Alternative Talk 1150. And listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.